Yes, the Asvatara, banyan tree, a material existence. And the real tree representing spiritual reality. And, alright, would you like to name some of that, just to recap, name the difference? Let's see,
I can write down the...
What is this tree reflected on?
Well, it's spiritual.
Okay, let me start further. What is the ultimate root of this tree here? Upside down tree here. What is the ultimate root of this upside down tree? The ultimate cause of the spiritual world? Krishna is the root of everything. Right? Remember Krishna? Krishna. So then we have the material world, which is manifested by Krishna's energies. The spiritual world, the spiritual energy, reflects as the material energy. So, in that sense, the material energy is like the root of this material manifestation. Okay. So, these here, what are they? They're the roots. Which are they're the roots which extend downward here in the blue. What are they?
The
branches which are nourished because they are nurtured by the roots, and they're nourished by the three modes of material nature. With those branches, some also go up and some also go down, and then see also that there are some roots which are coming down from these branches, some coming up and down from these branches. What do those secondary roots represent? This is all reflected on material desire. It's reflected on the waters of material desire. Those secondary roots, when one is in these branches, some in Brahmaloka, topmost branches, the middle planetary system, represented by passion, yes, here represented by sattva, and down below represented by tamas, is the lower planetary systems. Those branches also representing the various bodies that you would develop on those planetary systems. One develops karma in this earthly region, the middle planetary system, and by that one can go up or one can go down. So therefore there are branches going up and there are branches going down of the main branches. And for instance, if one then goes to the upper planetary systems or the lower planetary systems, one will develop a certain, it will create a certain impression in one's heart, giving one a certain type of attachment and aversion, in which case when one's karma runs out and one comes back to the earthly planetary system, that attachment and aversion is the seed of their desire for future activity, which is the seed of their karma, which continues the cycle. So they're the secondary roots that, in other words, from here there are actually secondary roots taking them back, and from here also secondary roots taking them back. So everything is connected. We've said that these branches represent the planetary systems and the bodies that one develops, the tips of the branches representing the senses, and the twigs at the end of the tips of the branches representing
objects.
Objects, and what we left out last, and we'll get to that, but the leaves representing the Vedicins, they nourish the tree, and they're very attractive. Just like any tree, its foliage makes one attracted to that tree. They also nourish the branches and the roots and what have you. One who is attracted by the leaves, which represent the Vedicins for fruitive activities, does not know this tree of material existence. Those who are attracted by the Vedicins, representing those religious activities which are carried out really to go up and down in this material world, does not really know that tree, nor how to cut that tree down. And the fruits, which we left out last time, are the four different fruits that you can taste through the various Vedic ceremonies of Dharma, Artha, Karma and Moksha. Okay, and as we also describe that understanding, now the impersonalists, they say that this tree of material existence rests upon Brahman. Right? So they're taking into consideration that 180 degrees. That tree of material existence is resting upon Brahman in that 180 degrees. But it is reflecting the other 180 degrees, which makes up the whole picture, whereas the Brahman without the three modes of material nature, and therefore it is understood, just as whenever we see a reflection in the water, we can immediately understand, even a child would understand, oh, I see a reflection, there is the tree at that. I see a reflection which is resting upon the water of material desire, resting upon Brahman, the reality makes up the complete picture. 360 degrees. So that's where we left off. And one has to, by detachment and surrender, to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, one can cut down the tree of material existence like that. So, exactly that process of surrender is described in verse number 5. I don't think we read that, so perhaps someone could just read the translation of that. I think it's verse number 5. Where are we? Yeah, someone read verse 5.
Those who are free from false perceived illusion and false association, who understand the eternal, who are done with material lust, who are free from the realities of happiness and distress, and who, unbewildered, know how to surrender unto the Supreme Person, attain to that eternal kingdom.
So, Prabhupada makes the point in the purport that the first qualification is that one should not be deluded by pride. So that is everything begins from there. So we won't, any questions on that so far? We won't dwell a lot there, yeah?
Im Shloka says, and we don't know how to surrender until the Supreme Person attains to the eternal kingdom. So is just knowing how to surrender is enough, or do you actually have to surrender?
You have to do it.
But then why does he say just?
No, you're saying that perhaps the wording should have been one who knows how to surrender and surrenders.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Because in one sense, this is the beginning. Prabhupada says in the purport that when one is free from delusion caused by pride, he can begin the process of surrender. For one who is always expecting some honour in this material world, it is not possible to surrender to the Supreme Person. Later in the purport, again, at the bottom, Prabhupada sums up, he says, he gives an order of things that, okay, first, pride, we have to give up pride, which is caused by illusion. We don't understand things properly, we're falsely proud of things that we shouldn't be proud of. Prabhupada says one has to get out of this false notion that human society is the proprietor of this world, so that's a pride. When one is free from such a false notion, he becomes free from all the false associations caused by familial, social and national affections. Right? So, as described in the... Right? So Prabhupada is giving a sequence that these things are not arbitrarily just plonked in there, but one thing actually leads to another. Get rid of false prestige and pride, which is based upon illusion, that will encourage one to actually give up the false association of those who foster that pride. those faulty associations bind one to this material world. After this stage, so he's saying there's stages, one has to develop spiritual knowledge. So one first understands material world, material illusion, then you have to develop spiritual knowledge. Cultivate knowledge of what is actually his own and what is actually not his own. When one has an understanding of things as they are, he becomes free from all dual conceptions, such as happiness and distress, pleasure and pain. So he sees that the world is not just based upon, my conception of what's for my pleasure or, something for my... that I dislike. He becomes free from that conception, understanding it's actually for the pleasure of the Supreme Lord. He becomes full in knowledge, then it is possible for him to surrender to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there's a lot of prerequisites leading up to the point to surrender. So from the understanding if you explain to people, anyone in the material world, those different steps, so they have to first understand that and then surrender. So they're unbewildered and they know how to surrender to the Supreme Person, they attain to that eternal kingdom. So at this stage, Krishna has actually given the stages up to surrender. He is not, in one sense, asking, just give up everything and surrender to me. He says that to Arjuna later.
Isn't it related to just your question to general praises in the scriptures?
Yeah.
Knowledge is never just covetous. Knowledge is always denied. And a learned person is always judged by his actions rather than
What you're saying.
I think from what you're saying is that for normal people it's even hard to understand, first of all, how to surrender.
Yes.
To even know how to do that is the hard part. So
yeah, there's that is a stage in itself,
yeah.
And that comes, after quite a while in itself. To know how to surrender means you have to get through this stage, this stage, this stage, and this stage, and that will put you in a position where then you can surrender. That's what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself, that knowledge, is very rare, very difficult. What to speak of those who actually then surrender. Krishna has in the seventh chapter, he did say that those who surrender unto me can easily cross beyond my material energy. So he actually has stated that. But later on he just says, now just give up everything and do that. I've said that that's the way that it should be done, now just do it. Here he's describing that, it is important to know that one has to know how to surrender. One has to know that process. One can't just... these chapters here, 14, 15, the last six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita emphasize jnana, or knowledge. Bhakti is the ultimate message, but there's a strong emphasis on jnana, whereas in the first six chapters there's a strong emphasis on karma. So it's developing that knowledge which helps one come to the point of surrender. One cannot surrender, in other words, if one doesn't know what surrender is, one doesn't know the process, so he's making the distinction. But in making that distinction that, there must be knowledge, there must be a process, he's not just saying that that's enough, because he's already stated you have to surrender in the 7th chapter, and he will state it again in the 18th chapter, that you must surrender. So, although he's emphasising one point, we have to keep in context verse 7:14, right? Where he said that to get out of material existence, you must surrender. So, of course, for us, we can forget that verse, because as we go through the Bhagavad Gita, we sort of struggle to keep up with the current verses, and what we studied in, previous chapters can sort of somehow disappear. But in Arjuna's mind, it'd be crystal clear, Krishna's already said, I must surrender. So that, coupled with this verse, is complete. Nothing is actually left out. Alright? shall we move on? Does someone like to read text number 6? Just the translation.
That supreme abode of mind is not illuminated by the sun or moon or by fire or electricity. Those who reach it never return to this material world.
So Krishna describes it. What is the destination of those who do understand the process of surrender and actually do surrender, then they attain Krishna's eternal abode, which is not illumined by the sun or the moon, nor by fire or electricity, and those who reach it never return. So there's two very important points Krishna makes at this point. So it's something worth going for. It's interesting to note also that from, from 1 to 5, actually discusses this banyan tree and how to cut it down with the act of detachment and surrender. From verse 6 to 20, I think there are 20 verses in this chapter, it discusses Purushottam Yoga, right? Which is the yoga, the understanding, connection with the Supreme personality of Godhead, the supreme enjoyer. How would this verse connect to Purushottam Yoga?
Those who do this yoga, they go to the eternal abode.
And who lives there? Purushottam. They go to Purushottam's home. That's what it's saying. So it's the beginning of Purushottam Yoga that they, of course, he, Purushottam, Supreme Lord, he is residing in the spiritual world. So it's the beginning of understanding that he is completely aloof in this situation. He is enjoying the spiritual world, as we've discussed, which is full of variety, because this material world being a reflection of variety, there must be full variety and happiness in the spiritual world. The other interesting thing about this verse is, as we go on in the next section, Krishna describes how he assists the living entities in this world, where we need the sun, the moon, the fire, what have you, by himself becoming those things. So there's a connection there also with Krishna's description of the material world as opposed to the description of the spiritual world. So that, although those things are not required in the spiritual world, they are required in the material world, and Krishna provides those facilities, which is described a little later. Text number 7.
The living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. Due to conditioned life, they are struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind.
Yes. So, Prabhupada uses this term, and we hear it constantly in Prabhupada's writings and lectures. The living entity is the fragmental part and parcel of the Supreme Lord eternally. What do we make of those terms, part and parcel? Why do we use those two terms? What does part imply?
Not the whole.
Yes. So, not one in quantity. Right. But being a part, it must be one in quality. What would this parcel indicate?
Relationship of propriety.
Independent entity. Eternally, we're talking about something spiritual by nature, so its qualities are eternal. It's eternally separate. Minute independence. It's not like a stone. So, very important term, part and parcel. Sums up.
And
it's one in quality. Supreme Lord has independence. The part and parcel has independence. But because it's not one in quantity, it's just minute. And that means the living entity, as we will discuss here, is free to wander up and down in the material world as he chooses, or he's free to cut down the illusion of material existence and actually return to the spiritual world. So he has, they're his choices, they're his independent choices. But it is minute in the sense that it's not complete independence. Even for that, the living entity has to depend upon the Supreme Lord, as we describe in the verses that come up now, the sun, moon, fire. We're completely dependent upon the Lord for everything we do, whether in our bondage and for liberation. And that's what's described up to verse 15. So there's some independence here, but not complete. Any other questions on that? And of course, that's a key memory verse, that one. You all know that, don't you? Here, get one of the key memory verses. It it's a very important verse as far as describing that the living entity and the Supreme Lord are simultaneously one and different. Now, this is a it confirms the same points that were made in chapter 2, that the living entity does not become God. Right? He is eternally a fragmental part. Eternally fragmental. It's not just because they're in the material world that they're fragmental. Even after liberation, when they, as it's described in the previous verse, those fragmental portions can go back to the spiritual world with Krishna, Purushottam. If they were not fragmental as the Mayavadi state, then if there was one living entity liberated, then all living entities should be liberated. Right? If they're not fragmental, one living entity becomes liberated, every living entity should be liberated because they're all one. But we don't see that. We see that one living entity becomes liberated and another doesn't. They're bound. And at the same time, as described later in this chapter, that there are fallible living entities in the material world, infallible in the spiritual world, and beyond that there's the Supreme Person. So it's a very important verse. You know, if anyone ever says that we are one with God in all respects, you really just read them that verse, and that will just defeat that philosophy very quickly.
If we are one with God, then we should be already liberated.
That's right.
Because God is not attached.
Then there should be no question of needing liberation in the first place.
Because you should be already liberated.
That's right, because otherwise, that's the one thing that the Mayavadis, the impersonalists, can never explain. How is God, who is supreme, come under illusion? That means that illusion is supreme. not God. But the very meaning of God is that person who is supreme above all things. So if he is not supreme because the material energy or the illusion is supreme, then there's no question of calling that person God. So it defeats the very term of God in so many different ways. It's an important verse like that. So then we move on. Any other questions on that? We move on to okay, verse number 8. Someone like to read that?
The living and living material world cherishes different conceptions of life from one body to another, as the air cherishes aromas. Thus he takes one kind of body and again puts it to take another.
Very good description here. Do we need this here anymore? Is everyone quite happy with that? Does it want me to leave that there? What was I going to draw? Or a container which contains very, very subtle material sense object in the form of aroma. The wind comes along and picks it up. So then the wind has the aroma like lotus flowers. It's very, very subtle, but explaining that something that we have practical experience of every day, even though it's so subtle that we can't see it, we can't perceive it. It's such a nice example. In the same way, the living entity is carried by his subtle desires, subtle body. His subtle body carries his subtle desires into his next life. Although it is something that is so subtle we can't perceive it, it works off the same principle. One can't say, oh no, that is too subtle, that is not possible, because there are many things which are very subtle which cannot be perceived, and yet we know that they exist. So Krishna's given that wonderful example there. Thus he takes one kind of body and again quits it to take another. He carries different conceptions of life from one body to another. He's actually carrying the living entity. He has a drawer. Just use stick figures. There's a happy person in his tear of body. Right? So, he has his different material conceptions of life. All of a sudden, he dies. And The subtle body comes out of the gross body. And he, what he's actually carrying is the subtle senses of the next body.
Next body or the earlier body?
What's that?
He's carrying the subtle senses of the next body.
Yes. The subtle body is carrying the subtle senses of his next body.
Okay.
Very subtle. And so it comes. Little doggy. He is very happy. So, now, in this verse, the unusual thing is that Krishna actually describes this person here as Ishvara. You see in the translation, in the word for word, uses the word. What's that?
The control of the divine
body. Utkramatishvara. The Lord of the body. Right? So, he has minute independence. So he is a little god, a little lord. Now he's a little dogging lord. But you know, he is, as in the form of a dog, he is a master of his kennel and his backyard, and you know, he's got a few bones buried here and there. He's a master of his domain. Perhaps lost some of the facility. And there. So, the subtle body, or in general the mind, is like a ball and chain. As described in verse 7, that he's struggling with the six senses, which include the mind. So, the mind, which is carrying his conceptions of life and developing the next lot of senses, is like a ball and chain, which is literally taking him from one birth to another in the material world, the material mind. But he, you know, he is, has some control in the sense that he can, you know, decide to go up the tree or down the tree, or actually to come to greater. Yeah. Yeah. Questions? Yeah. Read text number 9.
The living entity, thus taking another gross body, obtains a certain type of ear, eye, tongue, nose, and sense of touch, which are grouped about the mind. He thus enjoys a particular set of sense objects.
So just explaining this principle a little bit more. Because you know, his consciousness is adulterated, then he will take birth within any of the 8,400,000 different species of life. And as Prabhupada points out in the purport, that unadulterated consciousness is what we call Krishna consciousness. So just read the next verse.
Text number 10. The foolish cannot understand how a living entity can switch his body, nor can they understand what sort of body he enjoys under the spell of the modes of nature. But one whose eyes are trained in knowledge can see all this.
Okay. So here Krishna describes how the foolish person, this person here, who has a foolish person here, does that on, and he does not understand the process. And so, why doesn't he understand? Why can't he see? Why is he in that position of foolishness? Why doesn't he have knowledge? What's that?
He's under illusion.
Why is he under illusion? How do the modes of passion and ignorance manifest? What are some of the symptoms of the modes of passion and ignorance?
Illusion,
lust, yeah, desire, strong desire. So, because he's actually bewildered by his strong lust and strong desire, he's absorbed in those things, and therefore he cannot see. So they people become very foolish, being absorbed in strong material desires, and it just takes up all their contemplation, all their energy, in fact their whole existence, their whole life. Next thing you know, death comes along, take birth of the dog. They've not so that's where the knowledge, of course, allows one to conquer lust, material desire, material attachments, see the world as it is, and in this way, by cultivating knowledge, even of how the material world works, what to speak of transcendental knowledge, those persons who have discrimination that, I shouldn't just absorb myself in. I have this opportunity in the human form of life. Should I, like everyone else, just become completely absorbed in just petty material desires? Or, knowing that death is coming and that will actually ultimately be futile, is there some way that I can actually become liberated from this cycle of death, birth and death? So there's some discrimination there. Okay. If people don't exercise that discrimination and they just feel that I'll just become absorbed, whatever material desire comes, as long as it's reasonably good desire, I'll spend my entire life one after another fulfilling material desires up to the point of death, and therefore next birth and 1 in 8,400,000 different species of life. There's no discrimination. The foolish cannot understand how a living entity can quit his body. So they don't know, they don't understand how the subtle body carries the soul and the conceptions of life into the next body. They don't understand what sort of body he will enjoy under the different modes of material nature, 8,400,000 different species. Like that. They have no idea of these different things. Alright. In this verse, Prabhupada sums up a couple of statements which highlight the mood of ISKCON. He says that a person in such knowledge can understand how the conditioned living entity is suffering in this material existence. Therefore, those who are highly developed in Krishna consciousness try their best to give this knowledge to the people in general, for their conditional life is very much troublesome. They should come out of it and be Krishna conscious and liberate themselves to transfer to the spiritual world. So there, that's again the mission statement, very consistent theme by Srila Prabhupada. Alright, let's read the next verse, 11. Would you like to read that?
The undergoing transcendentalists who are situated in self-realization can see all this clearly. But those whose minds are not developed and who are not situated in self-realization cannot see what is taking place, so they may not
stand. Okay. Srila Prabhupada gives a very strong purport there that backing up Krishna's own statement, that there are those whose minds are not developed and who are not situated in self-realization, they cannot see what is taking place, even though they may try to. So there are many people who are trying to be transcendentalists. They don't know the process of surrender, as Krishna described. And they're following some process which is, Prabhupada describes it, so-called associations of yogis, but actually they are blind in the matter of self-realization. They are simply addicted to some sort of gymnastic exercise and are satisfied if the body is well built and healthy. They have no other information. Even though they are endeavouring in the so-called yogi system, they are not self-realised. Such people cannot understand the process of the transmigration of the soul. And then he says that really only the bhakti yogis engaged in pure devotional service can understand how things are actually taking place. So we'll just go on to the next verse.
The splendor of the sun, which dissipates the darkness of this whole world, comes from me, and the splendor of the fire are also from me.
Could you read the next two verses as well?
I enter into each planet and by my energy display in orbit, I become the moon and thereby supply the juice of life to all vegetables. I am the fire of digestion in the bodies of all living entities and I join with the air of life, outgoing and incoming, to digest the four kinds of foodstuffs.
Yep. So, yes. Okay. So here, Krishna has described. Why would Krishna then? There's a definite change in his description. He's actually been describing those who can see this process of transmigration and those who cannot, and the reasons for it. All of a sudden he starts explaining how he is the sun, the moon, fire digestion, and these various things. Why would Krishna do that? What is the underlying thought there?
Coming back to the original theme, but initially he started from in the spiritual planet there is no light or it's self illuminating, and from the he's coming back to the material world, how he's manifesting the same principle.
Yes, so he's doing that. Why would he do that? Why is he now explaining those principles.
Because the living entities are, those who are suffering, that living entities described in the previous verses are present in the material world, and how Krishna is supporting the material world through this.
Okay.
Maybe he's trying to say that he's also present in this material world in this way to kind of tell us that he's there and we should go back to him.
I can certainly, yes, you know, you're correct. You're correct also that these verses are attracting us back, yeah, to the spiritual world, that's correct. And what you're saying, Krishna is describing how he is manifesting his various opulences in the material world. Why? You know, still there's something else which is actually very important. He's not this, well, yes, that is part of what he is saying over there, that he is the cause of the various manifestations. Yes, to attract us, that's what you're saying, to attract us to surrender. It has to do with the fact that he's just described those who cannot see what is happening. What's that?
Because purpose
of Supreme, spiritual. Yeah, that's just some of the technical information describing how he is those different teachers. But there's still an important link between the verses. All of what you're saying is correct. It does have to do with the fact that this person here, runs in the corner, doesn't understand, he can't perceive what is happening in this cycle of transmigration.
Maybe he's holding to carry.
What's that?
Just to make them realize, those who can't come to the knowledge, that even that they can't take even these basic things in life for granted, and they are just not there by a chance of accident, and that they are actually there because they have been treated that way by the Lord.
Yeah, that is part of it. That is part of it.
Because this is
dealing with Let me ask this way. In one sense, who's it directed to?
To
describe the foolish person who has no knowledge. He can't perceive the soul, the super soul, and what have you.
But he can perceive
the sun. He can see the moon. He can see. So these are things that Krishna is describing. That even as us in the corner, you know, he's giving him examples, him or her, which are just essential for material existence, which are perceived by everyone. No one can say that, you know, I cannot perceive the sun or the moon or what have you. There's something that can be perceived by the material senses, even by a material person who is not advanced transcendentalist, but in these examples they give that person the opportunity to gradually come to the point of perceiving the essential role of the Supreme Lord. Okay. You know, not to speak of advanced devotees, but even the materialists. And we see that, you know, throughout the course of history, there are many primitive types of civilizations, you know, not very advanced in many, many different ways, and yet who have that understanding that, you know, when they see the power of the sun, you know, oh yes, you know, I can appreciate there must be God, some supreme force. You know, it is just so powerful, it is just so, you know, awesome, inspiring. So therefore, you know, many people who have, you know, very little access to knowledge or spiritual teachings or any elevated sort of ways, and you know, in some ways their worldview is a little primitive, and yet still those people, through seeing the sun and the moon and the fire and what have you, have an appreciation very easily that, oh, there seems, you know, I can appreciate the presence of a supreme lord, a supreme person. What to speak of, you know, people in a civilized you know, world, they should, these, you know, if one contemplates the sun, you know, if you actually think about the sun, what it does, how massive it is, you know, it just burns for billions and billions of years, and in that sense it's quite magical. You know, it's quite mystical. It's, you know, it's awe-inspiring. You know, it's very hard to sort of see something so amazing and then just, you know, put it down to chance, as really foolish people do. You know, most people, even primitive people, see something like the sun that is just so inspiring, just so big, so beyond our conception, even materially. You know, the thought of God just pops in your head, doesn't it? You know, the moon. And the other points, when that conception is there, then you can understand that not only there's a possibility of the Supreme Lord, because this universe is so wonderful, so powerful, but these essential things are maintaining us. You know, what would we do without the sun? So then you do think, you understand, oh, I'm very dependent upon the Supreme Lord. How can I say that I'm independent? And the moon, and the fire digestion in this way. The various yogis.
I want to draw a yogi, I want to draw a yogi.
He's sitting there. There's a yogi. He's he's meditating. You can see by the look on his face. Now, this type of yogi, some yogis who are really in the bodily conception of mind, they understand the importance of eating is maintaining their existence, and so they meditate upon the Lord Vaishvanara, I think they call him. Is that mentioned in verse 14? I think I spelled that right. Who sits in the, you know, you have the chakra down here, you have one in the navel, you have one in the intestines, it's the fire of digestion. Somewhere around here, and there's actually a form of the Lord, and his all pervasive feature who assists with the digestion of foodstuffs. Now, in the next, these type of yogis are not very described as not very intelligent. They're still very much in the bodily conception. And you will find them throughout the world. More subtle and more elevated are the ones who meditate upon the Supreme Lord as a Paramatma, situated in the heart. And that's described in verse 15, so I'll have to read that.
considering everyone's heart and come with humongous knowledge and forgetfulness. By all Vedas, I am to be known, indeed I am the compiler of Vedanta. And I am the knower of the Vedas.
So, in the actual process of yoga, the eightfold process of yoga, they follow the yama and the yama, the do's and don'ts. You know, live a wholesome life, the things you can and can't do. Asana, sitting postures. Pranayama.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jhana, so the meditation. You know, different levels of meditation until they get to samadhi. those who are, you know, can raise their consciousness beyond this chakra to this heart chakra, they're actually quite elevated. And there, Krishna, what is Krishna maintaining there in verse 15? So far, the sun, the moon, the fire, most of these things are actually maintaining our material body and material activities. The Vaishnava is a Kriya Shakti. By meditation on Vaishnava, they get Kriya Shakti, the powerful energy of activity, action. What are we? What is the Lord maintaining in verse 15? What's that? It is. It's actually the subtle body. Initially, so from here, the subtle body. Again, he's as Vaishnava. He's in the heart of all living entities. Was this in the yogis? And the Paramatma, seated in the heart, is also in the heart of all living entities. So he is awarding knowledge, forgetfulness, and remembrance to all living entities. You know, as Prabhupada gives an example that as soon as, you know, little puppies are born, they immediately understand that I have to call up to them and find the nipple and drink that milk. And how do they know that? And you see, you know, so many examples. You see birds, and you know, they fly thousands. Some of them up to something like 8,000 miles. Something incredible. You know, how do they know where to go? They go through storms, they go through all sorts of weather conditions. How do they know to, how to prepare, the time, there's an exact time they must leave. They can't leave too early, they can't leave too late. They know particular formations that they can fly in, particular, you know, height in the sky. So many different things. Very exact. They know how to protect themselves from various obstacles or whatever. How do they know that that is the Paramatma seated within the heart, you know, is actually maintaining the subtle body of all living entities, giving them
knowledge,
forgetfulness of the previous birth, so that they can absorb themselves in that current birth. Right? Otherwise, you imagine if you remembered thousands of births, and you try and, you know, you go home to your family, and you've got the picture of, you know, a million other children that you've you'd be wondering how much to cook for dinner. But remembrance, forgetfulness, and knowledge, how to do things. So that's for all living entities. But for the yogis. Now they're yogis who are actually proper yogis. You know, on this platform, worshipping Vaishnava, they're really absorbed in the body conception of life. But those who actually worship here, sometimes called Varunis, because they follow a very ancient saint called
Satyamuni is described a little bit in the Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 88, I think it is, text number 17 or 18, 18. with that knowledge, their consciousness, and the knowledge that is supplied by the Lord, he also maintains the process of liberation. So in all the previous verses we've said, the Lord is maintaining our material body with the most essential things, our subtle body, otherwise we couldn't function in this world without that knowledge we get from his remembrance. And even the yogis, those who want to actually become liberated, he is supplying the realization of their spiritual nature, the realization of the super soul, and ultimately when their consciousness is then enlightened, they can travel from the heart region to the top of the head, and he's got a hat on, but that's because he was a Vaishnava. But a yogi, he knows he's not going to wear a hat because he's ready to leave his body. Looks like Charlie Pan. The yogi, his consciousness moves up to the top of the head, where there's actually another form of the Lord. There are three forms of the Lord. And he can burst through at that stage, and he can actually go to the spiritual world, that yogi, or he can go anywhere he likes in the material world, according to the knowledge and the association he has developed. Generally, because people are very, very much attached to material association, sometimes they just want to go to different planets, even though they have that ability. They go to different planets, and other planets in the material world. Sometimes they mistake, they make the mistake of identifying themselves as the Paramatma, one with the Paramatma. If they actually haven't properly heard Bhagavad Gita from a devotee, they can assume that the that consciousness which is supplying the knowledge within the heart is themselves, and they are one. So therefore they may desire in personal liberation, which they can get. So it's very rare that one, unless one actually associates with the devotee and hears Bhagavad Gita from a devotee, they will generally not desire to go into the spiritual world for that. But the devotees, of course, they don't have to practice any of this type of yoga. The Supreme Lord, who is situated within their heart, he is also offering them the highest form of knowledge, realization of their own spiritual nature, realization of, as we've described also in this verse, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Therefore, Krishna says, okay, I am seed in everyone's heart. For me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. So we've described that part there, both materially and for liberation. Then he says, by all the Vedas, I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of the Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. So, Krishna, as Bhagavan, previously had in 1427, he's actually described that he is the basis of Brahman. He is described in the 13th chapter also, how he is the Paramatma, the super soul, seated within the heart of all living entities. And here, in this chapter and in this verse, he is describing that he himself, Krishna, is the person, Bhagavan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead Purushottam, who is actually to be known by all the Vedas. And how can he make that claim? Because he compiled the Vedanta. He compiled the conclusion. The Vedanta, when we say the Vedanta, if we take the Vedas, there are four Vedas, the Rig, Yajur, Atharva, and Sama.
many, many different rituals, for activities up and down in the material world, as well as some knowledge in the Upanishads pointing the way towards the spiritual existence. And in the Dantra Sutra, all that knowledge is summarized to explain that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the ultimate goal of Vedic knowledge. He is the one, Krishna, who is indirectly being referred to in the Karmakanda portions, and he is directly and, a little bit more directly in the Jnanakanda, and very specifically in some of the Upasana Kanda sections of the Vedas. Srila Vyasadeva, when he says there that he compiled the Vedanta, he did that in his form as Srila Vyasadeva, and therefore, because he compiled the Vedas, therefore he is the knower of the Vedas. And when Srila Vyasadeva, after compiling the Vedanta Sutra, he then wrote the I think it was the Mahabharata and the various Puranas, and the last creation I believe was the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is his commentary on the Vedanta Sutra. The Vedanta Sutra being the conclusion of all the Vedas, and the Srimad Bhagavatam being the commentary on that conclusion. So it makes it very, very clear. Any questions?
Bhagavad Gita
was
written by
yourself. What's that?
Bhagavad Gita
is part of Mahabharata. Yes, Bhagavad Gita, yeah. I think, there's Mahabharata. Sometimes you hear that Mahabharata was written at a certain stage, and then sometimes it says that it's written at a slightly later stage after some other literatures. That's because there is a version in the heavenly planets which is like a complete unabridged version of the Mahabharata, and the version that we have here, which I think is so many, what is it, 18,000 verses, is it?
Yeah.
I think 18,000 verses is just a little portion of the original Mahabharata for the Kali Yuga. So they were compiled at different stages. Any questions, comments? So, in this verse, just one more point. This, in Prabhupada's purport, he describes the Vedas give us the direction by which to understand Krishna, the process of realizing him, and the ultimate goal is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So they are known as Sambandha, one's relationship with the Supreme, Abhideya, how to revive that relationship, and Prayojana is how to, is the ultimate goal of developing that relationship. And that is further expanded in verses 16 to 18. So 16 is Sambandha, 17 is Abhideya, and 18 is Prayojana, which we will take up at another stage. Alright. That's it. Everyone satisfied? Okay.